This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى هذا لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take four of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5, and Intelsat 39, and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395 6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
From earth did God the untainted create you. So servant, earth-like, prostrate fall. Indulge not greed. World-burning restiveness, of earth you were created. Be not fire. While terrifying fire stretched forth its neck, earth cast itself down helpless. And since while one showed arrogance, the other mere deficiency, demons were made from the former and from the latter man. A raindrop trickled from a cloud, and was this confided to see the ocean's width. Where there is the ocean, who am I? If it exists, then truly I do not. But while with disparagement's eye it saw itself, an oyster shell within its bosom clearly cherished it. And heavens at length so far advanced its cause that it became an imperial peer, renowned. Elevation it discovered by first becoming lowly. Nothingness's door it pounded until existence came to be. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to your very favorite program, For a Better Life. Once again, this is Nahid, being honored to host you on another episode. Well, as you just heard in the poem a few seconds ago of the famous Iranian poet Saadi Shirazi, we are going to highlight some characteristics of a true Muslim, while, needless to mention, Saadi was also a Muslim person, and we are going to discuss humility. Welcome to your very favorite program, For a Better Life, where we provide you with most of the elegant pieces of information, and we all learn the life-saving messages. Well, what I said may look odd, right? But what if we, as normal people, do not highlight our efforts and get to be disregarded? That is the question we'll delve into today. The price for, and of course, the value of humility. The line between pride and humility is thin and thought-provoking. We are going to talk about it today. Like, what if a person, like me a few seconds ago, wants to mention and highlight whatever thing they are doing? Or if a person understands that what they are doing is not just for the sake of themselves and the others also, and is not that much proud, and tries to understand the other people as well. You know, humbleness is the opposite of pride. It is the ultimate form of respect towards others, honoring them and not disgracing them with arrogance. Without looking at their social or financial situations, humbleness is a proof as to the existence of good character, purity of the self, and sound sense. Humbleness is a sign that a person is strongly attached to his faith. It is the proof of good morals and means leading to paradise. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala had said, "The abode of the hereafter we granted to those who do not seek to exalt themselves in the earth or to cause corruption in it." So, as we can see here, we are not supposed to be in this world, exist on the earth, be proud of the things we have. Although still I have to mention that it is something that sometimes we disregard and we feel like if I'm not highlighting whatever good thing that I'm doing, then I'm kind of keeping a low profile of myself. But humility is something much more valuable and precious in our religion. Allah himself informs us in this verse that I just mentioned that the hereafter and its eternal blessings were reserved by himself for his humble, faithful servants who do not act arrogantly towards his other creation. Humbleness is one of the attributes of the behavior who do not behave with haughtiness or tyranny towards the others. When they are abused by foolish people, they do not respond likewise. They forgive them instead and say only that which is good to them. Allah said about this type of people, "The servants of the All-Merciful are those who walk lightly on the earth, and when the ignorant speak to them, they say, 'Peace.'" Allah enjoined on his messenger humbleness with people. It's like when we look at our Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam, we see the sample of a true person who, although is the last prophet, who has too many things and blessings to be proud of, he is still trying to be humble. And also Allah commanded him to never act boastfully towards people. Allah has said in Quran, "Be moderate in your tread and lower your voice." The Prophet used to command his companions to observe humbleness in their life as well and avoid haughtiness or arrogance. He informed them all of the benefits they would gain if they behave with humbleness and try to regard to their Lord and creation. Our Prophet has said, "Allah has revealed to me that you must be humble, so that no one oppresses another and boasts over others." So you see, I know it is sometimes disregarded, but still, when we just look at our history of creation and we see the Prophet saying so, we kind of get the understanding that, yeah, as a human being, as a Muslim person, I am also supposed to act upon this.
Your mercy, your love is all I need.
Is all I need.
All I need.
Your love is all I need.
All I need,
love is all I need.
All I need,
love is all I need.
Oh,
love is all I need.
To be love is all I need.
It has also been narrated from the Prophet, there are four characteristics that Allah gives only to those he loves. Silence, which is the first act of worship, reliance in Allah, humbleness, and asceticism. Again, this is one of the four characteristics. It's really important. Like when our dear Prophet is listing the characteristics that a true Muslim should have, he puts humbleness among them. Also, in a hadith Qudsi, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, Allah the Almighty said, pride is my cloak and greatness is my garment. So whoever competes with me regarding these two will be thrown into hellfire. So we have the opposite side also prepared for us in our religion. For us, as the creation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, we need to know and keep in mind that if we want a life which is full of blessings, if we want to be open to new opportunities, and if we want to be able to improve, to understand the teachings and implement them in our daily lives, we are supposed to stay humble. Although if we have, I don't know, a high situation, or even if, again, reminder to the poem, even if we are the king of the world, but we are not staying humble and we are too much proud and arrogant, we will stay alone and no one on this earth, at least, will help us. In the other, maybe there are some people to punish us for being that much proud. Namely, the story of Iblis and Quran. Remember? The story of Iblis and Quran and human, also insan, are somewhat similar and both teach us that we need to adopt the qualities of humility and submissiveness and avoid the destructive sins of arrogance and self-pride. So both would lead us to destruction in both worlds. Like he had the high value in place. He was the angel. But after just getting to be a little, not a little, getting to be proud, getting to be arrogant, he lost everything for the price of his arrogance, which is not worthy at all. Well, this is the end of this episode. Until another episode of For a Better Life, I wish you humbleness, I wish you blessings, and I wish you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied?
Chased by wolves, followed by a hawk. On the battlefield, you took your final walk. It took my breath when you said goodbye. But then again, heroes never die. Your final words were stay the course. Trust in God, the everlasting source. Don't give in to the enemy's plots. Resist with faith, go against the odds. Your way I follow, oh my hero. Unbreakable soul, unstoppable power. Until the last breath you never surrendered. Unshakable faith,
unwavering sacrifice. Make you the hero we'll remember forever. Your blood was spilled, but it nourished my roots. I then became a tree with many fruits. The fruits are love, courage, and resolve. You've made me a soldier, so you I salute. Your way I follow, oh my hero. Unbreakable soul, unstoppable power, until the last breath you never surrender. Unshakable faith, unwavering sacrifice, make you the hero we'll remember forever. A hero.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. The U.S. and some Persian Gulf countries spent billions of dollars trying to overthrow Syrian President Bashar al-Assad by sponsoring and equipping mercenaries from all over the world to create fear and chaos inside of the country. Well, the upheaval began in 2012, and due to the persistence of the Syrian military and the resistance front, Damascus did not fall, but has been continually under pressure since then. And once again, terrorists are on the move in Syria and threatening to destabilize the country and the government. But why now? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this. We'll come back right after this package.
More than a week after the resurgence of terrorist groups in Syria, heavy fighting continues across the country. The Syrian army reports intense clashes with militants on several fronts. Syria had enjoyed relative calm in recent years, but foreign support for terrorist groups and anti-Damascus actions by Western and regional powers have never stopped. Turkey has played a major role in supporting militants opposed to Damascus. Since the beginning of the conflict, Ankara has trained, armed, and provided bases for these groups. In 2016, Turkey launched a direct military intervention in northern Syria, occupying large areas that remain under its control. Recently, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan openly expressed hope for further advances by militants toward Damascus. The United States has significantly contributed to Syria's destabilization. Early in the conflict, the Obama administration covertly supported the so-called Free Syrian Army under the CIA's Timber Sycamore program. While claiming to combat terrorism, Washington's actions weakened Syria's central government, indirectly aiding terrorist groups. U.S. forces have also invaded and occupied eastern Syria, including its oil-rich regions. This occupation has deprived Syria of vital energy resources, compounding its economic crisis. Additionally, the CESAR Act of 2019, signed by Donald Trump, imposed devastating sanctions on Syria, further crippling its economy and worsening civilian suffering. Israel has exacerbated Syria's challenges by repeatedly targeting government-held areas. Damascus has highlighted the clear coordination between Israeli airstrikes and subsequent attacks by terrorist groups. In 2014, Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visited a field hospital in the occupied Golan Heights used to treat injured militants, demonstrating direct support for these groups. As the conflict continues, the prospects for peace remain bleak. The U.S., Israel, and some of their allies persist in undermining Syria's sovereignty. However, Iran has actively pushed for diplomatic resolution. On Friday and Saturday, Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi met with counterparts from Russia, Turkey, Qatar, Iraq, and Syria, emphasizing that only the Syrian people have the right to decide their future, free from foreign interference. Iran continues to stress that diplomacy is the only viable solution to the crisis.
Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, Leila Hatoum, Editor-in-Chief, MENA Uncensored, out of Beirut. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, let's start from here, because it's been just about over a week now that the terrorist group Hayat al-Tahrir al-Sham has suddenly become the top news in the region instead of the genocide in Gaza. I mean, being a journalist, being in this business, tell me your thoughts on that and how these two issues are related, if you think they are.
Well, first of all, good evening, and thank you for having me on your show. And
thank you for coming.
Thank you. And I want to start by painting this picture. Every single thing that happens, not only in the Levant, but the greater Middle East, is all tied together. And it's tied in a game of wars that are started by the U.S. and its allies in the West versus Russia and its allies in the East and some African nations. Every single thing pours into the Mediterranean, not only the Middle East, but the Mediterranean and the eastern side of the Mediterranean, which is the Levant. What's happening in Syria today not only takes away the light away from the genocide, the ongoing genocide that the Israeli occupation is practicing in Gaza, but also dims any news coming out from the West Bank, where the Israelis are continuing to kill, detain, and torture Palestinians over there and take over their land in the West Bank. Nobody's talking about the West Bank. Also, the Israelis had used the Lebanese front at one point in time to take the news away from what's happening in Gaza. Now the sexy story in international media, and it's on purpose being covered in international media as such, is Syria. Syria is critical at the same time, because if Syria falls, that means Lebanon is next. And if those two fronts fall, then there will be no real support at close proximity to the Palestinians. And that would mean Palestine will cease to exist, because the Israelis will find it easier for them to take over, and nobody from closer borders would be able to help out. So Syria is critical for regional countries. It's also critical basically for Palestine, and it's being used to dim the light and basically create what you call media blackout when it comes to Gaza and the West Bank.
All right. Well, I'd like to welcome our next guest to the program, Sakina Dato, journalist and producer out of London. Thanks so much for joining us, Sakina. Your thoughts. Why now? Why are we seeing the rise of this terrorist group, or I won't say again since it's changed its name, but the rise of this terrorism once again at this time in Syria?
I think this is all pre-planned. This isn't something that has just happened suddenly. The people, I think all of us, were caught a little bit by surprise, but in reality, they have been preparing for this. And this is precisely why we saw a ceasefire happening in Lebanon. Because if you look at the Zionist entity of Israel, they miscalculated when they started their war with Lebanon and thought that they'd very easily be able to overpower and overcome Hezbollah, which didn't happen. And in the last days, the huge beatings that they were getting from the resistance groups made them rethink that strategy. So the strategy was to kind of off balance, the whole idea of a ceasefire, thinking that they were retreating. But in reality, they were planning this all along with Turkey, Of course, there is the hand of the US, the NATO countries. These are all behind what we see in Syria. So the most amazing thing is that these same ISIS, you know, in their black clothes that were so despised here in the West, have just had a change of tone and a change of clothes. And suddenly they are palatable to the Western audiences. But these are, you know, this is nothing new. If you look at the whole idea of how the West has been playing the cards in the Middle East, it's always coming up with a sectarian card. Whenever they do not, you know, see any other way of winning the war, they try and create a sectarian war. Now, we know that what's happening in Syria has got nothing to do with Sunni and Shia. But that is what they are trying to promote. And the unity that we saw of Muslims coming together at the time of, you know, fighting this genocide in Palestine, very sadly, you know, I don't know whether it will hold or not, because there is a lot of psychological warfare in the media trying to make this look like this is a Sunni-Shia divide.
Interesting points. What about that, Layla? Your thoughts? Sakina said, the solidarity, the global solidarity we've seen across the board in supporting the Palestinian cause. How has that been affected with this current crisis in Syria? And why would it be affected, especially if we're talking about people of the region who understands what is happening with the Palestinian issue, but how could they separate that from what's happening in Syria, your perspective?
Well, I have to be very frank when it comes to this matter. People across the world are prone to following sexy news. That's the first thing. And the second thing is that international media dictates what you get to see in the media, including social media platforms that are not as innocent as you think they are. They're curbing the voices of those who support Palestine in favor of news that is coming out from Syria or elsewhere across the world. And when this happens, basically, the supporters of Palestine get divided. Some of them want to know what's happening in Syria because it's all over. And others basically try to figure out why it is important for Palestine to follow up on the Syrian news. And they get a lot of basically misconception and propaganda that's on purpose being distributed by the traditional media outlets that are controlled by America and its allies, along with the Muslim Brotherhood groups that are basically in favor of Erdogan, and Erdogan supports them, as well as Qatar supports them. At the end of the day, as Sakina said, and as you had said in previous shows as well, billions of dollars, not billions, hundreds of billions of dollars have been poured in to create this kind of propaganda since 2011 until today. And it's happening now for a reason. As Ms. Sakina said, the Lebanese front proved to be really hard for the Israelis. It is in favor of Hezbollah to actually have a ceasefire along the southern front so they can actually secure the northern Lebanese front and the eastern Lebanese front, which is basically the borders with Syria, because at any point Syria falls, we will have another wave of suicide bombers that comes into Lebanon, and basically they're going to kill our people. This happened between 2011 and 2013. Hezbollah intervened in the Syrian war in May 2013, 2 years and a half after it started. And that's how we managed to curb the waves of suicide bombers from there. At the same time, the Israelis found it really hard for them to take over Lebanon alone. So they moved the Syrian front to weaken Hezbollah internally. At the end of the day, a ceasefire does not serve the Israelis much as basically you move the Syrian front and you have Hezbollah engaged over there again. And we heard it. At the end of the day, you also have the SDF of or Syrian Democratic Forces that are found in East Syria. They said yesterday that they knew about this attack being brewed for the past few weeks. So everybody was prepared. They were just waiting for the green light for it to happen. The Israelis were planning it and the Americans were planning it.
Well, Sakina, the foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, and Turkey met in Doha within the framework of negotiations known as the Astana peace process. So your opinion about these talks?
We haven't heard much about what has been the outcome of it. But for me personally, I think, you know, at this stage, as we see this army advancing now towards Homs, I think this is, I'm a bit skeptical about the whole idea of a peace negotiation at this stage. I think it's critical that right now Iran and Russia really actually intervene in Syria directly. Because if these forces are now from Hama, if they manage to get to Homs, then, you know, Damascus is going to fall. And that is 90% certain that if they take Homs, then they are going to, you know, Damascus is going to fall. And like Sister said, I think, you know, this is critical. If Syria falls, then Lebanon is in a really dangerous situation. Of course, you know, all their efforts are towards Iran next. So I think if there was ever a time, this is not a time, in my view, you know, for peace talks. It's a time, I think, for the Russians and the Iranians to really act right now and ensure that, you know, whether it takes air bombing or whatever it is, to ensure that, you know, they get rid of these ISIS, these terrorists. It is very upsetting in a way to say that how is it possible that for the past 1 year, everybody has stood with the Muslims around the world, have stood with the idea of a free Palestine together. And it is so obvious with the statements that are being made by Turkey, the statements that are coming out from Israel, and this group also saying that they would like to establish relations. If they were able to capture Syria, they will establish relations with Israel. Now, it really is a question of the propaganda that is going on in the media. In Syria right now, people who are being interviewed there are saying, when they open their Facebook, for example, there is a bombardment from a certain group of the media. You know, Qatar is also there. And so we see their network very heavily spreading propaganda, a network that was up to now, you know, supporting the cause of Palestine. Starlink, for example, you know, this is something that the Americans are facilitating, whereas most people don't have an internet. You find that these rebel groups have got very strong internet. So there is a major war happening in the media. And what it is doing is that it's creating panic inside. So we continuously have been hearing about the fact that Bashar Assad has run away, you know, that there is incursions. These are not always true. So I think the media warfare is the one to really watch right now. And we need people from all around the world, these alternative medias that are also social media that are coming along. We have, if ever there was a job to do, this is the time to do it. There is such a lot of misinformation that even people who think they are aware of what is happening are constantly getting confused about all the different factors. So really, we are in very dangerous times.
Yes, indeed. Well, Leila, your perspective, Sakina had mentioned about Turkey. Let's look a little bit deeper into the role of Turkey in all of this. What does Erdogan want in your perspective? I mean, and why now? Why now in the middle? Once again, I'll go back to the genocide, because on the one hand, we know Erdogan, well, he sometimes talks a good talk about supporting the Palestinians, although the reality is something else. So your perspective, the role that Turkey is playing in all of this.
Was, is, and will continue to play, if you allow me to say that, if you may allow me to say that. Mm-hmm. Erdogan, since day one, has always sold people words. He's good with words, but he's a man of no action. He doesn't walk the talk. Much like Benjamin Netanyahu, he is called King Bibi for a reason. He can sell dreams to people at one point, but he doesn't actually fulfill everything. Erdogan had vowed to cut ties or sever ties with the Israeli entity since May 2024. Since then until now, he continues to send energy, oil tankers to the Israeli entity. Most of those are tankers that belong or are operated by his son, Bilal. And he continues to send perishables, among other things, to the Israeli entity. In fact, the Israeli ambassador to Turkey is still there. They didn't sever their ties with the Israeli entity. The Turks have not severed their ties with the Israeli entity. He has been doing it forever. He goes out and he cries over Palestine so he can actually sell some sentiments to the Islamic world and the Arab world. But in reality, over the table, he's still basically shaking hands with the Israelis. He did that back in 2011 and in 2012 and 2013. I remember I witnessed one of his antiques a week before he actually joined one of the forums in Sharjah back around 10 years ago. And I was attending that forum. He had signed a military agreement with the Israelis, and later on, a week or so later on, he actually came over to Sharjah and he cried over Palestine, which was very interesting to watch. And then By then, we understood that the game very well. He's supported by the Muslim Brotherhood, and he supports them. And his propaganda actually helps create or insinuate that everything is under control. But what Turkey really wants is to secure its borders with Syria. Remember, northern Syria, northeastern Syria, is PKK land at the moment. They are being supported by the Americans. The Kurds pose a threat to the Kurds, to the Turkish country. And at the same time, the Turkish people want to have Muslim Brotherhood in power in Syria. That's why they have military bases deep inside the Syrian territories. We're not only talking about the border lines, Tel Rifat or Azaz or others. No, we're talking about Idlib. They have military bases in Idlib, but not posts, military bases. And the Turks will not withdraw from there. They want to create a buffer zone, much like the Israelis are creating a buffer zone, basically with Lebanon and with Syria at one point.
Well, Sakina, I mean, Turkey has been occupying parts of Syria since 2016, as well as the U.S., which has occupied the oil-rich parts of Syria and still stealing its resource. Let's talk about how this has affected the overall economic situation, the security situation in Syria all these years.
So along with all those occupations, and also if you look at the sanctions and the effect that has had on the economic, ability of Syria, Syria was weakened. At the moment when you're asking why now, it's because at the moment Syria was in a weak position, not just Syria, but I think, you know, the area, the generally after this war, the genocide that has been going on, Lebanon, obviously, the last war we saw in Syria and the incursion of the ISIS, Hezbollah played a big part pushing them back. But at the moment, with the war that has just ended and there is a rebuilding happening, this was the most sensitive time. That is on one side. On the other side, you know, Bashar al-Assad was in the process of changing the army system. So whereas, you know, we know that there were Iranian military people, for example, in Aleppo, they were sent back, and he was trying to get this newer crop of young people who are really not yet, solid enough to be able to fight with those who have been given all sorts of support, by trained by NATO, given the best of ammunitions. So in a way, this was a weak point at which they could do this. That is one. But also, I mean, Turkey, I think Erdogan has always had the ambitions of the Ottoman-style ambitions of trying to expand and become a sort of a sultan. The other thing that ties in with this is the U.S. Now, in the U.S., the Democrats, know that when Trump comes in, Trump has, although he is not a great guy, and we know that, but I think Trump has been talking a language of, for example, wanting to withdraw his troops from Syria. Now, in that context, they know the deep state are the Democrats, and they know that when Trump comes in, the situation may change. So they wanted to make sure before he comes in January, they just go in there and do whatever they need to do to secure, Syria and the support of Turkey. At the same time, Israel also wanting, part of Syria. So I think all these things have aligned together at a time when the resistance in all parts have been a little bit weakened by the supporting, being against the genocide and supporting Palestinians.
And final question, Leila, where do you see this going? What needs to happen to change what we're looking at, the rapid aggression by the terrorists that we're watching now in Syria? In your perspective, what has to happen?
I'm not sure if everybody has followed the Doha meetings closely, where they presented a draft for a roadmap in order to solve the situation in Syria. I don't see any solution in the coming year, at least, a real solution at least. And that's because Syria has been severely divided sectarian-wise and when you call it basically also groups-wise, political-wise, even what you call the former opposition and the terrorists and the radicals, each one is trying to create a power grab before Trump comes into power. So nothing will be on the table and discussed thoroughly until Trump takes over. The Kurds are waiting for Trump to come over so he can give them a piece of Syria and Iraq and Turkey. The Israelis are waiting for Trump to come over so he can actually give them a green light or support what they are planning to do. When it comes to the Americans, Trump is not going to change the foreign policy. The U.S. foreign policy doesn't change. You change the presidents, but the foreign policy remains the same. The execution is what differs. I don't believe that Trump is going to pull out the troops. Remember, when he came into power in 2016, he had promised to pull out troops from Iraq and elsewhere. They continue to have one of the largest bases in the region, in Iraq, Ain al-Assad, as well as basically creating more. We have dozens of U.S. Bases in Syria, including in Atanf and Conoco. And at the same time, Trump just talks about it. Who bombarded Syria over the past few years during Trump's tenure? The Americans. So if you look at it, I don't see a solution. What needs to be done, I do believe, is basically for the Turks and the Qataris and the Americans and the Israelis to take off their hands and let the Syrians solve it among each other. Remember, President Bashar al-Assad had, since day one in Syria, since 14 years ago, called for what you call, or 13 years ago, called for political solution and discussions so they can reach a solution on the table. Only the Syrians would be able to change the situation on the ground so long that these powers that we just named take off their hands of Syria. I highly doubt it's going to happen. I'm being very realistic. For the next year, we're going to see the situation deteriorate unless in the next coming few hours, Russia manages with Iran to turn the tables. We know. We have heard information while I was coming down from South Lebanon to Beirut shortly before this show started that the Russians and the Syrian Air Force managed to hammer the terrorists who were approaching to Hamas, and they turned the tables also around Hama and
15 seconds.
Closer to Aleppo. Yeah, thank you.
All right. Well, thank you both for being with me, Leila Hatoum, editor-in-chief, Mini Uncensored out of Beirut, Sakina Datto, journalist and producer out of London. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
As we continue to witness Israel's brutal violence unleashed upon the Gaza Strip for more than a year, it's worth taking a moment to step back and follow the context of history to paint the larger picture. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. We'll be right back. Palestine Chronicle wrote, "Although it's only relatively recently that all eyes have turned to Gaza, and by extension Palestine, the reality is that this current display of savagery and inhumanity is not a sudden event or isolated incident. A quick look at the timeline exposes that this current genocide traces its roots to the very foundation of the fabricated regime of Israel in 1948 by the Zionist movement. One of the elements that is used to define terrorist organizations is an element called generating public fear. The Zionists, as a terrorist organization, did this intentionally. They wanted to generate public fear on all levels in Palestine, even within the British Army, as they were also targets. Meanwhile, one should remember that there is no one to protect the Palestinians. They don't have a police force or any such institutions. When there was a conflict between Palestinians called at that time Arabs and the newly expanded population of Jewish settlers, the British stood firmly with the Zionists. For instance, if the British discovered a gun in a Palestinian's house, they would punish the owner, maybe with death. The British also knew about armed groups or combatants within the Jewish self-imposed ghettos, but the British wouldn't touch them." At the same time, Palestinians were witnessing other villages near them whose communities were being massacred, like the well-known massacre of Deir Yassin by Zionists. At the time, there were no borders between Palestine and Jordan, Lebanon, Syria and Egypt. Therefore, many Palestinians facing this situation naturally chose to take some of their belongings, lock their doors behind them, and relocate to neighboring countries, believing it would be a temporary stay. This is to say, the threat of violence, together with the actual practice of violence, played a significant role in the Zionist actions on the ground to ethnically cleanse Palestinians and to depopulate historical Palestine in the Nakba of 1948 and to establish the fabricated regime of Israel. Usually, violence works ideally for the colonizer. Nevertheless, the moment violence stops being effective, that is a disaster for the colonizer. And looking at what is going on in Gaza, we can see that this is exactly what's happening. The maximum amount of violence they can exert stop playing an effective role in deterring the indigenous population from resisting blatant injustice. In the wars in 1948 or 1967, like always throughout history, the Zionist regime used violence efficiently. The Zionist regime was established through the operations of paramilitary terrorist organizations such as Lehi. Even the British government called them terrorist organizations at the time. Later on, when the Israeli regime was established, all of these militia fighters became part of the Zionist regime army. They went from being non-state actors as terrorist organizations or paramilitary groups to being an army of a structured, recognized state. And of course, we have to speak about Hasbara, the term referring to Israeli propaganda. It's important to mention that Hasbara propaganda started before the establishment of the fabricated regime of Israel. Zionists and later Israelis continued to construct lies and fallacies through Hasbara. For example, they present the army of Israel as the most moral army in the world. Even child killer Netanyahu during the genocide in Gaza kept saying that the Israeli army is the most moral in the world. Of course, in the face of the genocide, this false claim has been severely damaged. It needs no effort to expose this. It's very clear from the videos on the internet that are public for all to see. Another example is in the Israeli regime prison, Sede Tamon. It was confirmed and shown that an Israeli soldier was raping Palestinians. This incident went public in the occupied territories and created a national debate around the acceptability of such actions by the Zionist regime troops. In a survey conducted in Israel, the majority of Jews in Israel, 65%, expressed prison rape suspects shouldn't face criminal charges, that it's okay to rape Palestinians because they are the evil enemy. The state, according to terrorism studies, doesn't practice terrorism. This ties into the idea of the modern state as the new God. So, the state is viewed with the same reverence and superiority as God, traditionally the highest or divine authority. So, unfortunately, in terrorism studies and in assessing the literature of the field, the classical way of understanding terrorism doesn't connect terrorism with the state. For example, George W. Bush of the United States regime is not referred to as a terrorist because of what he did in Iraq or Afghanistan. The term terrorism is reserved only for non-state actors. That's why it's uncommon to see what the child killer regime of Israel is doing identified as terrorism, because it's seen as a state and these actions are acceptable from states. The term governmental terrorism is an exception, but that is used to refer to when states target their own citizens. In the West Bank and Gaza, it's not the Israeli citizens that are targeted by Israel, so that term wouldn't apply here. Hence, we need to rethink terrorism. Why it's unacceptable when applied to the state? Why it's only applied to non-state actors? As an experiment, try to recall an example of a terrorist organization. You will be able to name several groups, but you wouldn't name states. As an exception, perhaps sometimes journalists can label the Zionist regime as a terrorist regime. However, in academia, in mainstream media, George W. Bush will not be described as a terrorist. Even Hitler is always painted as evil, as a terrible criminal, but never a terrorist. Another example comes from Bruce Hoffman, one of the pioneers in terrorism studies. When writing about France's colonization of Algeria, he described the Algerian people who were fighting the French colonization as terrorists. This is very strange. Is the People's Liberation Movement fighting the colonizer terrorism? It is shocking to see this. It's worth noting that Hoffman has many books on terrorism. His works are well known within terrorism studies and included the syllabi of many universities, and many influential academics present the same perspective. That's why the concepts are politically constructed in a way that terrorism will not be used in the case of the state, and the Zionist regime is considered as one of these states.